Sunday's paper, the headline read, Iraqi parliament moves toward unity government. The clock is ticking. A month? Well, today, less than a month, to complete a unity government. That's what's been laid upon the new prime minister there in Iraq. We're going to be talking about that attempt to form this government in Iraq with Serge Trifkovic here in the first 30 minutes of Issues, Etc. This is, I don't know if you call it make it or break it, but this is a stage, a crucial stage, like all of them are, in that country that we still spend time in. The war is, well, if you still call it a war, 3 years old. And some, I heard someone today say, they thought it was not unrealistic to think that it could last 10 years. Well, that's a little sobering. We'll be talking about the unity government in Iraq in the first half hour. Mark the Evangelist will be the subject, and Dr. Peter Scare will be the guest in the second half hour of the program. That's the first hour of Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. In the second hour of the program, audio open lines, some recent comments by Dan Brown. He's done with his court case in London. He comes out successful. He's got a movie that's going to be hitting the theaters within a couple of weeks, and he says it's intriguing. It's captivating. It's hypnotic to watch this movie and see his novel come to the big screen. We'll also talk a little bit about a federal marriage amendment in audio open lines and a new report on religious rights. Very interesting. State Department comes out with these reports on religious rights, and I always like to bring them to your attention. Then, in the third hour of the program, a sermon review. Pastor Bill Swirla, a regular guest here on the program, preaches a Easter sermon. We're going to hear his Easter sermon, basically themed on if Christ is not raised, then what? Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We're back live with you Tuesday. It's the 25th of April, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Serge Trifkovic is a regular guest here on the program. He's foreign affairs editor for Chronicles, a magazine of American culture, and author of the book Defeating Jihad, How the War on Terrorism Can Be Won in Spite of Ourselves. Serge, welcome back.
Good to be with you again.
Let's start out with some general terms here. You have written about this in your recent book, Defeating Jihad, about the perils of democratizing the Middle East, and that's what we're watching happening here with the attempt to form a unity government in Iraq. What are those perils?
Oh, to put it very succinctly, that all over the greater Middle East, greater democratization leads to greater influence of Islamist parties. We've seen this in Algeria, where in 1994 the army intervened to prevent the ascension to power of an Islamist government after the victory of the strongly fundamentalist party in a general election. It also happened in Turkey in 2001, where the army did not intervene, but is keeping a very wary eye on the government of Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the prime minister, who calls himself post-Islamist, but we haven't really seen any radical break with the past, except for PR purposes, because Turkey is very keen to join the European Union. And also we witnessed it in March with the death sentence that loomed over the head of a convert from Islam to Christianity. And it was then that belatedly we realized that under U.S. occupation, Afghanistan promulgated a new constitution that clearly states that no legislation will ever be enacted that is contradictory to Islam, and that Islam is the basis of all laws. And likewise, in Iraq, the new leader, or the new prime minister-designate, to be precise, Jawad al-Maliki, belongs, just like his predecessor, Ibrahim al-Jafari, to the Islamic Dawah party. Now, Dawah is a predominantly Shiite, and now exclusively Shiite force, that was formed in the late 1950s, by, of all people, the uncle of Muqtada al-Sadr, the fiery and radical Shiite cleric, whose name was Muhammad Bakr al-Sadr. And the program of this party, which came into existence as a reaction against Ba'ath Party secularism, was eminently Islamist. absolute sovereignty belongs to God. Islamic injunctions are the basis of all legislation. The legislative authority may not enact any law that is in contradiction with the Quran. The people are only vice regents of Allah, so they're not really the bearers of sovereignty in any Western sense of the democratic term. And the jurists have to be Islamic scholars who represent Islam in the division of government authority. And they have to ensure that all legislative and executive actions are legal from the Sharia point of view. So to describe Mr. al-Maliki as a breath of fresh air and to enthuse over him as everybody and his uncle seems to be doing right now for from President Bush and Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld and Secretary of State Rice to a whole cohort of media commentators and West European observers is something extraordinary. Because let's face it, he can be described as a moderate and as a conciliatory force only in the context of an experiment gone very badly wrong. In other words, we cannot look upon Mr. al-Maliki in any light but the least of all evils that's available at this moment.
So it sounds like the bottom line here, Sergei, is that if they are successful in formulating a unity government, it is very likely, given the track record of democratization in Islamic countries, that that unity government will be Islamist.
Indeed. And let's face it, if Mr. al-Maliki himself, who resisted Saddam Hussein, not in the name of democracy, but in the name of Islam, because Saddam, let's not forget, was a secularist. Now, if he went to exile to Khomeini's Iran and then to Hafez al-Assad's Syria, and if those are the places where he felt comfortable being out of reach of Saddam Hussein, it doesn't bode very well for the future of the Iraqi democracy. Because, and also, it may not be a particularly significant detail, it simply illustrates the atmosphere right now, that one of the first leaders he spoke with on the phone was Iran's president and, you know, one of the major thorns in the side of the United States, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He called Mr. al-Maliki earlier today to congratulate him on his election by parliament, and he also said that the formation of Iraq's new government should pave the way for the exit of the occupiers. Now, I have no doubt that Ahmadinejad looks upon Maliki's appointment as something that Iran can sympathize with and support, because he reflects the Shiite interest. He is perceived as something of a moderate, so he's someone who can establish a modicum of rapport with both Kurds and perhaps Sunnis, although that one is a big if. And if his appointment leads to the calming of the waters and to the creation of conditions for the U.S. withdrawal, well, that's something that Iran would certainly support. They have no intention of creating a quagmire in Iraq that would bog down U.S. forces on an open-ended basis. They would like democracy to work, but the kind of democracy that, indeed, Mr. al-Maliki represents.
So if it is, in the end, an Islamist government that is formed in Iraq, even if it leads to the drawdown of U.S. occupation there, is this necessarily an improvement for the United States compared to the former regime of Saddam Hussein?
No, quite the contrary. I would say that in many ways, a powerless, declawed Saddam, surrounded by enemies and subjected to all kinds of humiliations, like oil for food program, like weapons inspectors, crossing Iraq at will, was a far preferable proposition from the security point of view. And I'm now talking simply in real political terms. I'm not talking about the moral desirability of introducing democracy left, right, and center, But again, it should be the interest of the United States rather than some greater global good that guides the decision-making community in Washington. And this is not the only such mistake that Washington has made in recent years along these lines. The ambiguity in Chechnya comes to mind. The support for some of the ugliest jihadist violent characters, like Maskhadov, and even if you cannot call it open support, certainly covert support of sorts, diplomatic as well as material, and it has really strained American-Russian relations at a time when, in the immediate post 9/11 period, it looked like finally Bush and Putin were on to the kind of rapport that promised to establish a firm footing for the relations. And let me also add an area that is very close to my heart, obviously, and it's the Balkans, where the support for the Islamist side in Bosnia, the and Alija Izetbegović, the leader of the Bosnian Muslims, far from being multi-ethnic, multicultural Democrats, was an Islamist par excellence who wrote in his Islamic declaration that there can be no peace or coexistence between Islam and other modes of social and political organization. And last, but by no means least, the support for the Kosovo Albanians, who, as your listeners may know by now, have blown up roughly 145 Christian churches and monasteries over the past 6 years, some of them dating back to the 13th century. So, really, the attempt to appease the Islamist sentiment by playing a geopolitical game that seeks to earn brownie points for the United States on one side and thus justify more than 5 decades of single-minded bias in Middle Eastern affair on the other is self-defeating because it does not breed gratitude, it breeds contempt.
We're talking with Sergey Trifkovic. He's foreign affairs editor for Chronicles, a magazine of American culture, author of the book Defeating Jihad, How the War on Terrorism Can Be Won in Spite of Ourselves. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. back live this Tuesday, the 25th of April. Sergey, the goal here that is sometimes stated and sometimes left implied by our leaders is that after all is said and done, whenever that is with Iraq, the best possible outcome is an ally in the Middle East. What kind of an ally would a unity government in Iraq be, to your way of thinking, to the U.S.?
A very uncertain ally indeed, because at the moment the only ally of sorts the United States has in Iraq are the Kurds, and their motivation is pure self-interest, because it was thanks to the U.S. occupation that they have achieved the level of autonomy that they could only dream about in previous times. And for as long as the U.S. forces remain on the ground, their gains are assured. Ironically enough, if the United States were to withdraw, the Kurds would feel uncomfortable not because of the Sunnis or Shiites further south, but because of their Turkish neighbors to the west and to the northwest, because Turkey has been most uncomfortable with the Kurdish de facto autonomy in the northern third of Iraq, and it fears that this might have domino effect on the Kurds in western Turkey, who had waged intermittent guerrilla warfare against the government in Ankara for years. The Sunnis, of course, regard the Americans as their enemies, because under Saddam and for many generations before that, they were traditionally the holders of political power in Iraq, even under the Ottomans. And the Shiites are very pragmatically acting as the de facto partners of the occupation authority, while at the same time trusting that by the time the U.S. withdraws, the institutions will be in place that will guarantee that two-thirds numerical preponderance of the Shiite community will translate into something closer to 80% of all political power. So we are looking at a maze, at an equation with many unknowns, in which one thing is for certain: not a single party in today's Iraq or even the greater Middle East seeks partnership and friendship with the United States on the basis of the shared ideals of human rights, democracy, free markets, and all the rest of the globalist come neoconservative rhetorical spiel.
What is causing the strife between the Sunnis and the Shiites?
It is not so much a fundamental difference of outlook and religious sentiment. It is the fact that, to a large extent, Iraqi tribal divisions are also reflected in denominational or religious affiliations. The problem that we are witnessing right now is that the Sunnis do not feel that they have a stake in the emerging state of affairs. The Shiites in the south have oil wells, and so do the Kurds in the north, but the Sunni triangle in the middle does not. If, on the one hand, they feel that they have lost political power, and on the other, they feel that the other two communities will control most of the oil revenues once the production is back online, they feel that they have precious little to lose. In the Shiites' case, there is also the desire to get back the Sunnis for many decades of, frankly, quite brutal oppression under Saddam. But it has gone to the other extreme, so much so that the al-Badr brigades, the Shiite paramilitary group affiliated with Iran, has very successfully infiltrated its cadre into the Iraqi Interior Ministry and even into the Defense Ministry, so much so that they were even able to operate a clandestine prison on the premises of the Interior Ministry, where U.S. forces last fall found dozens of emaciated and badly mistreated prisoners. And there, the al-Badr people in Iraqi police uniforms are widely blamed for many individual murders of Sunni politicians and community leaders, as well as acts of intimidation against the community as a whole. So you have tribal cum religious denominational affiliations also translating into established patterns that we've seen elsewhere of the link between political power, paramilitary thuggery, and criminal activity. So if and when Iraq can get rid of the syndrome of the mix of Middle East and duplicity and Latin American chaos, maybe we'll be on to something. But I am afraid that Jawad al-Maliki does not have the following and the authority to clear up the mess at the Interior Ministry. And that, by the way, is the one ministry to watch. If we get yet another person affiliated with the al-Badr brigades as the head of the Interior Ministry, you can place a hefty bet on the continuation of a bloody conflict, because unless and until the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution, which is the political cover for al-Badr, gives up the control of the Interior Ministry, there can be no improvement.
Finally, the thing on the mind of most Americans probably is the price of gas at the pump, and the oil prices continue to rise, $75 a barrel as of this morning. What effect, if any, will there be from the formation or the failure to form a unity government in Iraq on that kind of bottom-line concern many Americans have?
Well, the news is rather gloomy. Even if there is a unity government within the next 30 days, which is the deadline that al-Maliki has, the problems, both security-related problems and technical problems of getting Iraqi production back to full capacity are immense. But worse than that, I believe that before the end of the year, there will be a major crisis with Iran. Many observers in Washington are of the opinion that the question of American military strikes against Iranian nuclear installations is not if, but when. And yet, if that does happen, then all bets are off, because one unknown is how will the Shiites in Iraq react to that. They feel a great deal of affinity with their co-religionists across the Shatt el-Arab River. And even during the Iraq-Iranian war back in the 1980s, many Shiites felt that their loyalty was with Iran and not with Iraq, which is why Saddam clamped down on them with all ferocity of his secret police apparatus. And also, if the Iranians retaliate by curtailing production or even by carrying out attacks of their own against oil installations in Saudi Arabia, in the Gulf, in the Emirates, then I wouldn't be surprised if oil were to shoot up to well beyond the $100 mark, to maybe $115, $120, $125, with catastrophic consequences for the world economy, because at that level, the effect on the rest of the world would be comparable to the first oil crisis in the aftermath of the Yom Kippur War in 1973.
ChroniclesMagazine.org is the website for Chronicles, a magazine of American culture. ChroniclesMagazine, all one word, .org. Sergei Trifkovic is foreign affairs editor for Chronicles and author of the book Defeating Jihad, How the War on Terrorism Can Be Won in Spite of Ourselves. Sergei, it's always a pleasure, and thank you for being our guest.
It's my pleasure to be with you, and I hope that my gloomy predictions don't come true, but I am in the habit of being right.
Sergei, that's why we value you as a guest, and thank you very much, in spite of the gloomy predictions.
Thank you. Bye.
When we come back from this break, we're going to talk about Mark the Evangelist. Today, the church remembers perhaps the shortest, not in stature, of course, but in terms of the number of words, simplest, most direct. Someone said Mark's gospel kind of shows a comic book of Jesus, not a cartoon, but blow by blow, line by line, without a lot of extra detail. We're going to talk about the author of Mark's gospel with Dr. Peter Scare, assistant professor of New Testament at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, when we come back. And then we've got audio open lines in the second hour of the program. Lots of things to talk about with you, and a sermon review in the last hour. Pastor Bill Swirla preaching an Easter sermon, If Christ Is Not Raised, Then What?, in the third hour of Issues, Etc. Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for April, even though April is almost gone, is a children's book. My daughter even asked me the other day, she said, why you guys have a children's book as your book of the month? Your show isn't for kids. Well, it is for the parents of kids. It's called Mommy Promises, and it's a connection between the love that mother has for child and the greater love that our Father has shown us in Jesus Christ. For more information, we'll have to give you the information on the other side of the break about our Issues, Etc. book of the month for April, Mommy Promises.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
If you're a regular listener to Issues, Etc., you know that every month we offer our Issues, Etc. book of the month. Our book of the month for April, it's called Mommy Promises. It's a children's book about the unique relationship between mother and child. All of our Issues, Etc. books of the month are available from Concordia Publishing House. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or Concordia Publishing House also operates two bookstores in the St. Louis area. One is at 3558 South Jefferson in the city, the other on the campus of Concordia Seminary here in Clayton. Their toll-free number again, 1-800-325-3040. Concordia Publishing House carries our Issues, Etc. books of the month. Our book of the month for April, Mommy Promises, 1-800-325-3040, or at 3558 South Jefferson in the city, or on the campus of Concordia Seminary.
From the National Institutes of Health, this is NIH Health Matters. We mentioned in our last report that sleep apnea can cause excessive daytime sleepiness, leading to potential work and driving accidents, in addition to the cardiac and stroke-related risks. Dr. Carl Hunt, director of the National Center on Sleep Disorders Research at the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, said one of the most insidious things about sleep apnea is that you may not even know you have this dangerous, potentially life-threatening condition until you see a doctor for some other reason.
It's possible. In fact, that's actually fairly typical. People tend to come to the doctor for evaluation either because the bed partner can't sleep anymore because of the disruption from the loud snoring and perhaps concern about the brief pauses that they hear.
Some of the treatment options for sleep apnea in our next report. From Bethesda, Maryland, I'm Bill Schmalfeld. This has been NIH Health Matters.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. My Meyer Minute is recorded for broadcast and web audio distribution by radio station KFUO. I thank the station for the great help they have been over the years. Hosting its annual Share-a-thon, KFUO invited me to be on the air, and I was teamed with veteran radio personality Ron Clem and program manager Chuck Rathert. We got into a discussion about dead air, time when the radio is silent. Most radio people hate dead air, even if it's just for a few seconds. They always want some noise going out. Talk, music, some noise. The three of us agreed that some silence, properly done, can be compelling. I tell my preaching students that a great way to compel your audience's attention is to stand silent for a few moments, and you are guaranteed to get their attention. That discussion reminded me of my favorite book, First Peter. Sharing the faith is a major theme in 1 Peter, but interestingly, Peter does not encourage a whole lot of evangelistic talk. Instead, he urges Christians to live a life that prompts others to ask, "What is it about you?" When that happens, Peter says, "Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope you have." When you are not talking, is the dead air compelling? And P.S., check out KFUO.org. It's a great resource.
The St. Louis Public Library and First Civilizations are proud to team up with the International Institute to celebrate cultures of the world at two mini folk festivals. The first of their kind to be held at the library, the mini folk festivals will delight you with free performances, dance lessons, music, arts and crafts, and storytelling. The festival will be held at the Booter Branch Library Saturday, May 13th from 9:30 a.m. until 5:30 p.m. Mini folk festivals celebrating world cultures.
Before the break, I told you about the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April, Mommy Promises. Let me tell you a little bit about where you can get this children's book. You can get it by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or you can go online to our website, issuesetc.org, and you'll find Mommy Promises right there on the homepage, issuesetc.org. Now, Mother's Day is a couple weeks away. Great gift for Mother's Day. Mothers can give it to their kids. Kids can give it to their mothers. It works both ways. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. I remember when, during my seminary education, there was the opportunity to take, I think it worked this way, there's an opportunity to take a course on one of the Gospels. You know, you took courses in the various epistles of Paul and some of them were elective, some of them were required, but I think we were required to take a course on one of the Gospels. And I believe at the time there was a Gospel of Mark course being offered. You know, Mark sometimes gets overlooked, except for that tricky last few verses, the longer ending of Mark. Sometimes it gets overlooked because you can find basically the same stuff in Matthew, and if you really want more detail, you can go to Luke, and it seems like all three of them are reading off the same page and singing out of the same hymnal. So some might consider the Gospel of Mark redundant. And then there's the question of who Mark was and who the church remembers on this day, remembering the evangelist of Mark. We're going to talk about that with Dr. Peter Scare here for the next half hour of Issues, Etc. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And we always have our in-studio email address here. Jeff is now able to check the email in his little producer's booth, leaving Craig free to do what he's hired to do and me free to do what I'm supposed to be doing. He'll check your email and we'll get your questions and your comments in here during our conversation with Dr. Peter Scair, issuesetc@kfuo.org. issuesetc@kfuo.org. Now, if you are want to tune into the third hour of the program today, this would be a great day to do it. We usually do sermon reviews sometime during the week. This sermon from Pastor Bill Swirla at Holy Trinity Lutheran Church in Hacienda Heights, California, he's also a guest on this program, is one that you don't want to miss. It's an Easter sermon, since the Easter season runs 50 days after the day. We'll continue to review his sermon from Easter in the third hour of Issues, etc. Dr. Peter Scair is Assistant Professor of New Testament at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He joins us to talk about Mark the Evangelist. Dr. Scair, welcome back.
Great to be with you, Todd.
What makes Mark's gospel unique? It's sometimes seems the third wheel between Matthew and Luke. What makes it unique?
Well, you know, I love the Gospel of Mark, and one of the nice things about our new curriculum, if I might say, what we're teaching at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne is that we're teaching all the Gospels. In the old days, you would get, you know, either Luke or John, and now, for the next 3 weeks at the seminary, I'll be teaching Mark. And Mark is a great Gospel because, in a number of ways, people think about when they think about Mark is that it's shorter. You don't have a birth story, and the resurrection story is also very truncated. But what you have in between is just a wonderful kind of almost a Lutheran emphasis. Mark is, in one sense, the most Lutheran of the Gospels, an emphasis on the cross. That if you want to know who Jesus is, if you want to find out what he's all about, you're going to find out on the cross.
So, some have said it reads like a newspaper because it gives only the barest of details, then only kind of what you need to know. A comic book because it gives a flash here, flash there, and there then very quickly, as you just pointed out, gets to the passion narrative. What do we know about the man who penned this gospel and why this gospel, while so similar to Matthew and Luke, does seem abbreviated?
Well, you know, I'll take issue with a little bit about it, that it's abbreviated in the sense that it doesn't have a beginning, quote-unquote, and an end. But in between, you get all these wonderful little eyewitness details, and actually in the stories that are similar to Mark and Luke, when they tell the same story, it's actually longer. So you get a lot more of the interesting details. Who Mark is, that's a good question. Mark got into the New Testament because he does have the apostolic connection to both Paul and then primarily, at least as history records it or tradition records it, Mark is the one who gives us the Gospel of Peter. That it seems to be the case that the Gospel of Mark is largely based upon the preaching of Peter. And since it is based upon the preaching of Peter, maybe it's a little bit in less of an order, and you have like a diversion here and a diversion there. But he's a companion of Peter and of Paul. Personally, Mark is an interesting fellow because he was a young man. He grew up in Jerusalem, and his mother, by the name of Mary, maybe one of the Marys at the cross, his mother Mary lived in Jerusalem. And was evidently probably a wealthy person. And we know in the book of Acts that the early church used to meet at the home of Mark's mother. And some people have brought forth the idea that the Last Supper might have been held in Mark's house. And I can kind of relate to that growing up in a theological family myself, my father being a pastor. It's a possibility that Mark would have been there at the Last Supper, except maybe in the other room with his ear to the door or something like that, that he might have very well been a young man and an insider who then, as a young man, then became friends with Paul and then later with Peter. Now, Mark is also like us in any number of ways because he's a man of, like Peter, he's a man of failings and weaknesses. He was a disciple or a student of Paul and he went with Paul and Barnabas on the first missionary journeys. And he, in the middle of those missionary journeys, he decided for one reason or another to leave. Maybe he was afraid. Maybe he was didn't have his heart in it. Maybe he wasn't steadfast. And then Paul kind of divorced him in the middle of the book of Acts, saying, "I don't want anything more to do with you." And thank God for Barnabas, because Barnabas took Mark under his wing, and Mark was able to mature as a person and as a theologian and as a pastor. Until he was, you know, the rehabilitation stuck, he became a friend of Peter and ended up writing the second gospel.
You know, as to the writing, I remember one of my older seminary professors, because, and I may be getting this completely mixed up, my memory's a little fuzzy on these things, seminary was a long time ago. One of my older seminary professors would regularly tell us that don't believe anybody if they tell you Mark's gospel was written first. And I think he was kind of reacting to higher criticism that put Mark first and then had everybody else copying off of Mark and trying to discount the veracity of Matthew and Luke or something like that. Do we know when or who wrote first? Does it stand to reason because Mark's is the most, or at least seemingly the most outline-ish, that perhaps it was the first?
I don't think Mark was the first at all. And I think the reason Mark is considered the first by many, or got that reputation, and it only got that reputation in the last couple centuries, is because liberal scholars thought that the birth stories of Matthew and Luke were legends that were written after the fact. So we know that if you're going to confess that Jesus is the Christ, somehow you have to say that he was born in Bethlehem. Well, we know that Jesus is Jesus of Nazareth. Therefore, they constructed a story to tell about somehow, like Luke, there was a census, somehow he was born in Bethlehem. And likewise with the resurrection stories. The liberal scholars say, of course, we know that if we don't know whether Jesus was resurrected or not, but those stories must have arisen later. Therefore, the Gospels of Matthew and Luke must have been later. That was unfortunate, because then Mark not only becomes the first gospel, but in a sense you lose the excitement of Mark, because Mark is at once primitive. I think it's primitive in a way that you find out things about Jesus that you don't find out in the other gospels, in the sense that, you know, the fad used to be to wear these bracelets, what would Jesus do? And I guess maybe there are still some of those around, but when you read the gospel of Mark, you never know what Jesus is going to do. He seems unpredictable. The symbol for Mark is he's the gospel of the roaring lion. He's like C.S. Lewis's lion, where he's a lion, he's good, but he's not tame. And in the gospel of Mark, you find out more about the person of Jesus, and yet he's kind of this mysterious, enigmatic figure. He's not who you want him to be. And so I do think it matters if you... I don't think Mark was the first. I think the way we teach it at the seminary, we teach it third. And I think Mark is, in fact, kind of a commentary, in a sense, on the Gospel of Luke. That's my personal opinion.
One of the features that even the person casually familiar with Mark's Gospel will notice just on the first read is that he has a habit of beginning each section or each little vignette with "and immediately." And immediately.
Yeah.
And any Greek student learns that little word if they read Mark's gospel. Is there any point to this, or is this just the writer's habit?
Well, if it's any habit, it's not the writer's habit. It would be the speaker's habit, in the sense that I know, you know, when you teach for a while, your listeners do pick up on any verbal tics that you have, and you start repeating certain phrases, and it can be embarrassing. There is a sense that there are two things that Mark does as far as these kind of verbal, and I think he's picking up actually on the preaching of Peter there. I think it's a very verbal gospel, and I think this is the way Peter actually spoke. There are two things. One is this immediately thing. Everything happens right after another. It's like there's this headlong rush to get to the cross. There's a sense of urgency. And I think that sense of urgency is born out of persecution. It's very interesting. When you look at the Gospel of Mark and you look at the temptation scene, Mark tells the temptation of Satan, of Jesus being tempted by Satan in the wilderness for 40 days. But whereas Matthew and Luke tell what the three temptations were, Mark doesn't tell anything about that. He just says Jesus was in the desert for 40 days being tempted by Satan, and he was with the wild beasts, something like that. So Jesus was with the wild beasts in the desert. Well, if this gospel was written, let's say, in Rome, maybe during the 1960s, during the 60s, then it very well could have been written to a church in Rome that is undergoing persecution, and part of that persecution is the fear that you might be thrown with the other Christians into the Colosseum with the wild beasts. So it's a stripped down gospel in a way to say what do you need, what does the church under persecution need? And know that Jesus will be with you in persecution. Jesus himself was with the wild beasts during his time of trial, and he'll be with you also now.
Let's talk about the beginning or the lack of a beginning, and the end or the lack of an end. Now, the end is a little more troublesome, but the beginning is very little question. He just starts out with the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, which is a fitting beginning. And then he jumps into the narrative of John the Baptist. So why none at all? Why no account of the incarnation, the conception and the incarnation?
Well, I think that he looked at Matthew and Luke and saw two beautiful portrayals of the birth and said, it's been done. So he moves on. I don't think he doesn't know the story. I think Mark's apostolic authority is based upon Peter. And Peter in the book of Acts, when he makes his speeches or sermons about Jesus, one of the criteria for being an apostle is that you are with Jesus from the time of his baptism up until his death and resurrection. So in this sense, it's very much the eyewitness account, or includes the eyewitness account of Peter from the time that he was called. The other thing is, what's very, I think it's intriguing about the beginning, is it says it's the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And we might think in two ways here. It's the beginning of the good news, but it's also, I think, this is a title for what is a new genre. And people ask, what kind of book is Mark? When Matthew was writing, he was writing Scripture. I mean, I think he was writing the completion of the Old Testament. When Luke was writing, he was also writing Scripture, a kind of an answer or the other side of Matthew. And then by the time Mark writes, it's actually a separate kind of a book. So he's recognizing that, I mean, here's the first indication of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, particularly as Gospels. So I think this is a kind of an identification as to the type of book he's writing. It's a book about the good news of Jesus Christ, or a book of the good news. And I think at this time people are also calling these books Gospels.
The ending is a little more troublesome, because if I'm looking at it right now, if you have a Bible that has any kind of critical apparatus or notes in it, it will have something to indicate that after verse 8 of Mark chapter 16, there's a big question mark hanging over the rest of those verses, the so-called longer ending of Mark. What's the basic problem here, and how far should we read Mark 16 before we say, okay, from this point on, the ice is thinner as regard whether or not it's genuine Mark stuff?
Well, in chapel today, we celebrated St. Mark's Day, and our reading was from like Mark 16:10 and following or something. It was beyond. It was on the. And at the end, they say this is the gospel of the Lord. I think. I think what you have here is, and again, 16:1-8. It seems pretty certain that that was the original begin end of the gospel, and it ends, I mean, rather starkly with the woman being afraid. You don't have the appearance of Jesus. You have the note that he is risen, and the women are told to go out and tell, and they don't say anything to anybody, and they are afraid. I think that's the way Mark wanted it to end, because It's a recognition. The whole Gospel of Mark is about how discipleship is a rocky road. And, you know, when you come into the church, you always think you're going to meet these wonderful spiritual people, and they are going to really take you to the seventh heaven. And you find, I mean, inevitably you're disappointed. And in the Gospel of Mark, it's a stark reminder that the church is not only populated with sinners, but it's led by people like, you know, you and me, who are stumbling along, doing our best, but often falling in our weaknesses. You know, sometimes we don't see clearly, and that's the nature of the church, the way the church is always going to be until our Lord returns. We're always going to be like a ship tossed about on the ocean, struggling for survival. Just as Jesus' ministry is defined by the cross, the church's existence is defined by suffering, sorrow, sin, unbelief. That's just part of who we are on this earth. So I would say 16:1-8 is what I would call the director's cut, like in a movie. It's the way that Mark really wanted it to end. My feeling is just like in a movie that ends too badly, the audience previews it and says, this ends in such a distressing way. Can't you lighten it up a little bit? And then I think that's what the extra verses are in the Gospel of Mark. And I'm open to the idea that I think Mark very well could have written the other verses, but they are of a different kind of a character than what's been written before.
So in other words, no real textual reason to call the longer ending into question, except that because of the manuscript evidence, there was an awful lot of Mark floating around that didn't have those last verses in it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first, it's pretty clear that the first ending was Mark with 16:1-8.
So why does he end on this? I mean, we went to the vigil on Holy Saturday, okay? And the reading there, the end of this long service, didn't even get to verse 8. It stopped with, come see the place where they have laid him. And the pastor yells out, Christ is risen. And a beautiful way to end the Easter vigil. But this is a pretty dark ending. Or even, you know, there's an empty tomb, and the women basically run away because they're afraid.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, because I think it's an antidote to Luke, because in Luke ends with the disciples' eyes being opened and the breaking of the bread, and it's very positive, which is definitely one aspect of the church. But Mark is a reminder, because you can also overemphasize. You can hear people say, "I'm a resurrection Christian." And you can say, I don't want to have a crucifix that's too depressing. All I want is the empty cross. I want a risen Lord. And it's fine. I mean, we preach the resurrection every Sunday, as well we should. But you can't preach the resurrection to the exclusion of the crucifixion. We preach the crucified risen Lord And Paul says, I am determined to preach nothing among you but Christ and him crucified. So I think it's Mark's way of saying, yes, the day of the resurrection is true. Christ has been raised. However, we still live in the time of the cross. Our preaching is the preaching of the cross. And it's also it's nice of an antidote when, again, people become Christians and expect the heavens to be open wide, and it doesn't happen. And Mark is a recognition of that reality, that we're still living in this sinful world, and we're often like those women, afraid and perplexed. And the fact that we are afraid and perplexed should not then make us doubt that we are indeed Christians, should not then make us doubt that Christ did indeed rise. The fact that our lives aren't perfect now should not then make us doubt the truth. And they should, when our lives are the messes that they are, then that should drive us back to the cross, where we see God's love for us.
The material in Mark, you were mentioned early on, seems to drive forward to the passion narrative. And this seems to be the model for the other gospel writers, too. The 1 week of Jesus' life that receives pound for pound more ink from all the gospel writers is the passion narrative. And why so in Mark's case? What is his point in driving so quickly to Jesus' suffering, death, and resurrection?
Well, because it's the the passion or the death of Jesus is the hermeneutical key, or it's the way of reading the entire gospel. If you understand the cross, then you can understand the entire gospel. If you understand the cross, then you can indeed understand all of the scriptures. All of the scriptures are nothing else but a preaching of Christ crucified. So he does drive headlong into it. The one thing he does drop, besides the birth story and a lot of the resurrection accounts, he doesn't even have time for talking about the Sermon on the Mount or the Sermon on the Plain. He doesn't include a lot of the teaching of Jesus. But I think it's not that he's saying the teaching isn't important. In a sense, Mark is a supplemental gospel. You got to really, I believe, start with Matthew, then go to Luke, and then Mark. But Mark, it just crystallizes it in the cross.
Before we let you go, Peter, I know that you've been involved with Christ Academy, and that later this summer at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, you'll be holding another Christ Academy. With only a minute here, tell our listeners about this two-week residential program for high school-aged men.
Yeah, Christ Academy is a great program. I'm going to be teaching again this summer. And I don't know what I'll teach, probably maybe on the Gospel of Mark after this. What we do is we bring in 50 or so young men from the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod who have an interest in perhaps taking up the call of our Lord and following him into the ministry to become shepherds, to be workers in God's field. And we take high school kids. We have 2 weeks. It's run as academy. The guys have a great time together. They are treated, as adults here. They have a great time in the classroom. I have a great time teaching them. And the day is filled with worship. This is a no-nonsense academy. We're not here to entertain you with clowns or with pseudo rock bands. We're here to give you good stuff, good theology, great worship, and then there's a great sense of camaraderie which comes out of it. It's amazing the friendships which develop out of these high school kids being together, studying God's Word in worship together. And then there are a lot of fun things, too, like going to Cedar Point, going to the amusement park, doing all the roughhousing games that high school kids seem to like. So it's a great chance for high school kids to be together, to study God's Word, and to be taught by seminary professors.
For more information about Christ Academy 2006, 1-800-481-2155 is the number of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Or find more information at our website, issuesetc.org. Dr. Peter Scares, Assistant Professor of New Testament at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne. Thank you very much for being our guest, Peter.
Thanks, Todd.
When we come back, we're going to be talking with Mary Ann Hackett for just a few minutes about, they're funding stem cell research in my home state of Illinois.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.